It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 5.3.
Training a posse of zombies to defend our compound for when the man comes around on death's back.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have with us today Rhiannon Frater.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. We're here to talk about The First Days, which is a very interesting zombie apocalypse novel, which we've been getting a lot of zombie novels lately, which I love.
We have?
Yeah, we've Alden Bell, and then we had James R. Knapp on.
Oh, that's right.
And then we have one coming after the White Trash Zombie book.
Oh, that's right.
And so a lot. And it's okay by me because zombies are the only thing that scare me anymore. So so let's start off with the easy question, which is what led you to writing fiction and why zombies?
Well, to answer the first question, the minute I learned to talk, I was telling stories. I was a storyteller right out of the gate. And as soon as I learned how to write, I started writing stories. So I guess I was born a writer. Zombies, I never intended to write a zombie novel. It was never anything I had planned. I didn't see myself writing in that subgenre, but I had a very vivid image come to my mind that ended up being the opening scene of the book, and I had to write it, and that's how I ended up writing about zombies. It came to me, the story came to me, and I had to write it.
So had you always been a zombie fan, or was it just because of that image, which, by the way, is one of the most terrifying and disturbing things that I have ever read. I'm still trying to get it out of my head. So, yeah, were you always obsessed with it, or was it just because of that image?
Well, I would have to... My first love of zombies was watching the Old Republic films and Hammer films, so I was more toward, like, the whole mummy, Dracula, vampires, you know, Frankenstein-type monster, and then I saw Night of the Living Dead probably when I was, I'm thinking between 12 and 13, and I wasn't really a kid who watched a lot of horror movies, so it really terrified me. It really, really scared me. In fact, it scared me so bad I swore I would never watch it again, which I did in my 20s when I had a boyfriend, and it really frightened me, but then by that point, I had found my niche in writing, which was horror. So I went and found all of Romero's films that he had put out to that point and watched all of them. And I really, really loved them. And I thought he was amazing. And of course, there was the zombie resurgence at the beginning of, I think it was like around 2002, 2003, zombies started kind of coming back, kind of hitting our in the theaters and stuff like that, which was really kind of fun. And by then, I would say I was pretty much officially a zombie fan. I used to get into arguments with filmmakers I know and other writers saying, no, slow zombies. But so we got into all these arguments, fast zombies, slow zombies. Like I said, I never really thought about writing a zombie book. But when I started writing this, it was originally an online serial. And I started writing in 2005. At that point, there were not a lot of zombie books. Of course, that's changed now. And one of the most popular books at that time, of course, was Day by Day Armageddon by J.L. Born. And so when I was looking for something to read, like in, you know, the stuff that was written online, the original stuff that people were posting online, it was mostly the military guy with the gun, you know, alone in the wilderness of zombies, killing things. And that's okay, but I never saw myself reflected in any of those stories. So I think that was one of the main reasons that when this vivid image came to my head, that's the opening of the book, which is a mother standing on the porch of her house, staring down at the front door, the bottom of the front door, where her zombified toddler's fingers are reaching underneath, trying to get to her. I was like, okay, I gotta write this, because this is different. This is something I would want to read. So I wrote it.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that image back to me now. I think I had just gotten rid of it.
It is a really vivid image to start the book off with. Like, if you're going to start with a hook, like, that's a pretty good place to start. So you mentioned, you know, you originally started this as a serial. And I'm kind of curious, how did this project end up being with Tor? I mean, how did you end? Where did it go from when you started writing it to Tor?
Well, 2005 to 2007, I wrote it online and ended up with a huge following. In fact, the counter that was tracking the story reset itself 3 times. Each time it hit 150,000 views. So a lot of people were reading it and repeatedly reading it. And they would leave comments constantly and this sort of thing. So I never considered it to be like my real writing, I guess. I just kind of regarded it as something for fun, and I was doing my real writing on the side. But it became so popular, and the fandom was so rabid, and I had fans, which kind of freaked me out. I was unpublished and had fans, that they started clamoring for me to get it published so they could go and have their own copy. And at the time, what I had written was not the thing that people were looking for. They weren't looking for a zombie book that had 2 female protagonists in it, set in Texas. They were looking for something different. They weren't looking for what I had written. So when I got done writing in 2007, I faced a lot of rejection until early 2008, when my husband said, the new media is here. We can use publish on demand. We can self-publish. You can get these books out to your fans. You know, we have friends that are artists. We can do this. So we did. We self-published the books for the fans, because the fans really wanted it. They sold very well. I ended up with even bigger fan base. The books, the first 2 books won the Dead Letter Award back to back years, 2009, 2010. And by the time the third book came out, which is Siege, when I self-published it, it had gained so much attention that it was optioned for a possible TV show or film. And at that point, the entertainment lawyer that I had hired to help me with that deal said, I think it's time to get an agent. And within a month, I had an agent, Hannah Brown Gordon from The Foundry in New York City. And this is toward the end of 2009. She pitched it in January 2010. Tor bought it by March 2010.
Wow.
So that's kind of, it just, like I said, I wrote it for fun, and it just took on a life of its own, and here we are.
Jen, I'm going to interrupt, because you mentioned a TV show. I really wish AMC had done this instead of the garbage they did with The Walking Dead.
Thank you. I take that as a really big compliment. In fact, I think when The Walking Dead kind of happened, it might have kind of shucked mine off to the side a bit. But, I mean, I haven't given up hope, neither has the producer. It may not happen this year, but maybe it'll happen next year. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, every day I get emails from fans saying, I wish this was a TV show, or I wish this was a movie. I prefer a TV show, because then you don't have to cut a lot of stuff out, and,
yeah,
you know, you can even add things in, you know, and have fun with it. But, I don't know. We'll see. I'm just shocked that I'm where I am right now. So, you know, I don't know what comes next. We'll find out.
Millionaire.
Great. <That'd be> nice.
So were you producing fiction on your blog or website before you started doing this? I mean, did you already have kind of a following, or was this a new thing that you had just started doing for this?
It was a spur of the moment thing. It really was. I had no intention of putting anything online. I didn't know what I was doing, quite frankly. It was just, I wrote something. I'm not really a short story writer. I originally thought it was a short story, but that idea lasted all of like 30 minutes. But I realized, I don't know how to say it. I think I believe there was no place for it to go. And I didn't want it sitting on my hard drive unread. And then, you know, blogs, were forums, everything had zombies on it. And it just seemed like a way to share a story that I was enjoying with people. I did not anticipate ending up with a fandom. I did not anticipate ending up with a 3-book deal with Tor.
I know exactly how you feel. I get that way too, because I do a lot of science fiction and fantasy, and I'll have stories and I'll be like, I wrote this and I have no idea where to put it.
Yeah.
It's an awful feeling.
Well, and I just feel that, you know, and as a writer, and now that I've played both sides of the fence, I have self-published and will continue to self-publish some of my projects, and I've also now traditionally published. I can see there's a difference between the two processes, but I have also recognized the fact that you have a lot of competition now, and I think people need to see that you can write a story, that you can write a story and finish it, and I think free fiction online is a good way to go, and I do still put up free fiction when I can. So
awesome. So getting directly back to the book, one of the things that I actually really loved about the first days was that you kind of avoided some of the worn-out tropes of zombie stuff, which, particularly with your two main protagonists, who, not ruining anything, but you learn pretty quickly, one of them is a battered housewife.
Right.
Jenny.
Yeah,
and her husband, of course, is no longer with us in any non-zombie fashion. And, of course, the other character, Katie, is a lesbian bisexual woman. And I say that because that becomes relevant in the story, the lesbian bisexual nature thing.
Well, yeah, the fact that she's bisexual means that she's holding a lot of her mourning to herself, because she's not really sure how these people around her are going to react to her lifestyle, because she is in rural Texas. So she's not really sure what their viewpoint will be. And, I mean, you know, if you're a straight person and you're mourning your dead spouse or your dead children, that's acceptable to everyone. If you're a bisexual woman who is married to a lesbian and you're mourning her death, that may not be acceptable to a lot of people. So that was that had a huge impact on her.
And of course, these are not, you know, sort of helpless women. I mean, Jenny sort of starts a little bit helpless, but mostly it's apparent because she's shocked. And actually, this seems, in a sort of sick way, this shocking moment in the beginning actually seems to help her come out of that.
Well, the thing is, with the two female protagonists in the first days, is Jenny is a battered housewife who has post-traumatic stress disorder and the battered housewife syndrome. So she is able to disassociate from terrible events that you and I or other people may not be easily, could not disassociate from. She's learned to compartmentalize her fears, and it's a coping mechanism. It's something that's actually can work against her in our, you know, in regular life. But when the zombies pop up, it actually allows her to function, and maybe function a little bit better than other people, because she disassociates from reality. She just blocks that portion off. People who are battered oftentimes have amnesia. They will forget for long periods of time terrible things that have happened to them. They will remember it occasionally, but the only reason they're able to deal with day-to-day life is because their mind says, you will not be able to deal with your regular life right now if you are remembering this constantly. So it compartmentalizes it and puts it aside. So that's why Jenny is able, I think, to become something that she wants to be. In a way, the zombie rising allows Jenny to become the person that she wants to be. It doesn't mean that she's mentally well, necessarily. I think she suffers quite a bit, but she's a very dynamic character, and I have to say she's probably the most popular person in the entire series. Katie is also a very strong female. She was a prosecutor. She's, you know, her father was a Marine. But at the same time, I have to say, I'm from Texas. And learning to hold a gun and shoot a gun is not uncommon here. I know a lot of women who carry concealed guns, and we're talking, you know, 78-year-old grandmas. My mother could nail someone from a long distance with her shotgun. So, with her rifle, actually. So shooting is not an uncommon thing in Texas. And knowing, and women in Texas are pretty tough, I think. So for me, I had a problem watching movies where the girl runs around screaming. and waiting for someone to rescue her, because here in Texas, most likely that woman would be reaching into her glove compartment to pull out a gun. So, you know, that was, you know, and the gun culture in Texas is something that people who are not from Texas aren't used to. And, you know, we do have hunting stores all over the place, and, you know, it's part of who we are. So,
yeah. And it was something, it was a little jarring for me. And I think now that you're explaining it, it makes a lot more sense, because, you know, a lot of the characters who you've never seen actually hold a gun all of a sudden are, like, really good shots, and they're shooting one. And my first thought, because I don't live in Texas. I live in Florida, where, I mean, I'm sort of not quite really part of the South. And it's,
more importantly, originally from California.
Originally from California, so I'm a crazy liberal. You know, so we don't have guns and, you know, paintball gun, but that's about it. So... But I mean, you know, like I'm very much disconnected from that. I've never had that experience. I've never even fired a real gun.
They have an awful kick, just so you know.
Yes.
Yeah, and they smell horrible. And they're scary when you hold them. They really are. When you hold a weapon like that, you instantaneously have respect for it. I mean, my nephew, when he was 12, was given his first hunting rifle. You know, kids at camp learn how to shoot. And in fact, I had a criticism from a fan wrote me this long email about why there would be no guns in the Zumpocalypse. I just wrote back, I'm in Texas. You know,
Yeah, that doesn't even make sense to me. I mean, I'm in California, and that still doesn't make sense to me. Maybe because I'm in a slightly rural town in California, but even in the middle of the city, there's going to be guns.
Cops carry guns. And there are cops everywhere.
There is a very popular, a lot of people used to take pictures of it. I don't remember what highway it was off of. It wasn't an interstate. It was a highway here in Texas. But you would go through a town and it would have a sign that said guns, riflery, daycare. And later the daycare closed down and it said donuts. And it was just like, oh, yeah, that's Texas, you know. I remember when, in the 60s, there was a shooter on top of the UT Tower.
Yeah.
And he killed a lot of people. It was a horrible tragedy. But one of the things that caused problems for the police officers trying to get to the top of the tower and apprehend him was the fact that everyone went to their car and pulled out their guns and started shooting back at him. So that's Texas. And the reason why I have fast zombies in my book, even though I'm a big proponent of slow zombies, is because I had to have Texas go down. And the only way I could figure that would happen is if they were fast.
Slow zombies not going to work for Texas.
No, we would just be sitting back, you know, drinking our beer, watching the news, going, God, they have it bad elsewhere in the country. What's for dinner, you know?
Those damn liberals with all their anti-gun legislation. No, I'm just kidding.
No, Texas is real laid back. I mean, Texas mentality, people who don't know Texas, if you go out to rural Texas, most of the time people just really don't care about anything as long as you leave them alone. You know, as long as they can do what they need to do. And you know, I have... You know, my husband's family, when we go visit them, there's a good chance that, you know, they'll be shooting. So, I mean, it's just part of our culture. And that's one of the things I think is fun about these books, too, is you get to see Texas. You get to meet Texans. You get to see how we are. And we're not perfect, but I think we're pretty tough. And we still have that mentality from the Alamo. So I think, you know, we'll stand up and fight to the last person. So
that actually kind of leads me to my next question, because, I mean, beyond Katie and Jenny, who are awesome. I'm a former Jenny with an I, so I have to say thank you. But your cast of characters is fairly unique in that they're really pretty normal people. And that somehow makes them even more compelling within, you know, the zombie apocalypse sort of world. I mean, yeah, in a lot of the zombie films, you have pretty normal people, but they're all panicking. Mm-hmm. So, and in this, they're all like, well, if we panicked, we'd probably be dead, so maybe we shouldn't panic. And it made more sense to me that way from, you know, a logical human being standpoint.
Well, I'm seeing it right now in Texas. Right now, we have wildfires that are 30 miles from Austin right now. The day before, we could see the plumes of black smoke coming out of the south side of you know, when we were driving around, but watching the news, I mean, it's like people are like, oh, my God, I can't get my horses off my property. And the next thing you know, there's a bunch of Texans driving out there with, you know,
with
their
trucks.
Trailers to get the horses. You know, people are like, oh, my God, I can't get my grandma out of the house. Instantaneously, there's someone in a truck, you know, a 4x4 going out there. The Humane Society has been taking in a lot of pets that, you know, trying to save them. Texans have a tendency that the minute that something like this goes down, it's a huge community. I mean, it's just like instantaneously, it's just they pull together and they just, they're like, we're not going down. We're just going to fight, you know. And I'm seeing that right now with the wildfires, and it made me think of the people at the fort that Jenny and Kate arrive at. The fort is used, you know, liberally there. It's not really a fort. And it's enclosed area. But they, you know, they're really like, okay, what do we have on hand that can help us defend ourselves? And we got to rescue as many people as we can. And we got to keep safe. And they're normal people. There's nobody, the only person that that is among them that is unusual, she arrives kind of toward the end of the book. You see her in the middle, and then she's toward the end of the book as well, is Nurit, the Israeli former sniper. But then she's 62 years old, too. She was a sniper in the Israeli army. And she's based off of some Israeli ladies that I actually know. So.
And that was the one that I pointed out. Aside from, thank you for pronouncing it for me, Nurit, they're all pretty absurdly normal. And yeah. it was a breath of fresh air to come in and see people actually kind of buckling down and dealing with things as opposed to just panicking and going off the deep end. Although you do have a couple of characters that do react in that way, you know, but that only makes sense. You're going to have a wide variety of people instead of a crew of people that are just acting stupidly and panicking, which seems to be fairly typical of some zombie narratives.
It's a trope. It's a trope, and it's a common trope, and it's one I disagree with every time. Like we're about to not celebrate, but commemorate the 9/11 attacks 10 years ago, and I mean, you saw it right there in New York City, the most liberal bastions in all of the country. When those towers came down, those people were out there helping each other, trying to rescue one another, even sacrificing their lives to help complete strangers. I think it's in the human heart to rise to heroic, to be heroes. And I think there will always be the minority who's going to take advantage of a bad situation. I think that, or be cruel or do terrible things and be selfish. I think that, but I think they're the minority, and I don't think they'd last long either. I think they would die pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in your novel, in the First Days, I mean, it's, you do have like the occasional like selfish individual. I mean,
there are bad people. I mean, there are bad people in all three books. I'm telling you right now, there is a group of people because they exist. They are there.
Yeah.
And they are the takers of society. They're the people who want to take from other people. And if they survive this apocalypse, they're still going to have that mentality. And there's always going to be difference of opinion also on how to deal with stuff. I don't believe in the trope where all of a sudden they're going to start fighting with each other and kill each other and the zombies are going to eat them. I just think I think it became popular because Romero was, you know, Romero did his movies in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's a very dark period in our history.
Yeah.
And I think it was a social commentary about the things that he saw at the time, commercialism, the rise of the military, the civil rights movement, things like that. I think he was, and people have held on to that very tightly, not taking into account, you know, recent events have shown that actually we're quite humane to each other. I mean, Katrina happened and there were people getting in trucks, going to Costco, loading up on water and food and driving down to New Orleans to try to help people.
Even celebrities were out there in boats trying to save people.
You know, I just really do think that, yes, there would be a really bad element, and they do show up in my books, though they are there. But I don't think that they would be the majority rule.
Yeah, and that's something I really appreciated about the book, is that it's not like, you know, everybody isn't devolve into cannibals and, you know, that they
literally
like your characters are, you know, they try to work together even though they have differences. I mean, clearly the people that are in the quote-unquote fort, I mean, mm-hmm. there are clear differences, like ideological differences, etc. Mm-hmm. But they all just sat down and went, look, we can't do this because we're all gonna die if we don't work together. And they're like, fine, and they'd work together. They don't like each other, but they work together.
I think you would want to survive. I think the thing that has always helped, like looking at history and looking at recent events, and even if we consider the fact that every day when you get into your car or you get on a bus or anything that you do, you're following rules that everybody in society, except for a few, have agreed to. The light turns red, you stop your car. The light turns green, you go forward. These are rules that we have all agreed to. This is what keeps us human. It keeps us going, keeps our communities intact. And I think after this apocalypse, yeah, there would be death. definitely having to restructure, rebuild. But at the same time, community is what makes us strong. And I think community would be instantaneously what the thing we would want to cling to. I think it'd be a much better feeling to have a couple of people at your back than being alone.
I should just note, I run red lights.
So. Well, there you go. You're the rebel.
He's lying. He doesn't even have a car.
I don't even own a car anymore. And one of the other interesting things to think about the book is the way you deal with morality, because one of the things that I think is often missing from zombie stories, in which yours does, and this is just going to be me just constantly praising your book, so get used to it. the fact that your characters actually sit down and discuss, like, the feelings that they're having about, you know, killing zombies and all of this stuff. There's a point where Katie actually gets upset with herself that she doesn't feel anything when she shoots zombies. She just does it. And it doesn't, and I think in particular she kills this fellow. I'm not going to ruin this scene, but she kills a guy who got bit, and she acknowledges he's going to turn into a zombie. It's over. And that for her, she gets really upset because she doesn't feel anything. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, could you talk a bit about how you constructed morality in your novel, since it's, you know, they're having to adjust. So I don't know.
I've read a lot about people who've survived horrendous events like tsunamis, wars, just all, you know, from natural events to man-made events of catastrophe, and how people survive. And the reality is, we have a great capacity to evolve, I guess, or to make ourselves fit into the new dynamic. And it may not be comfortable, but it's what we do. And at the same time, that's not going to absolve us from the feelings that we have. And I do know people that are in the military that have done terrible things and who suffer from it. I mean, my own mother-in-law was in several wars. She was in the first Gulf War and the second one. And she was a medic, and she saw terrible things. And yet she's one of the sweetest people that you will ever meet in your life. So you find a way to live with it, but at the same time, you have to live with it. And one of the things that's in the first days and in the two sequels as well, that I think is missing in a lot of zombie books, is it's almost like the zombies rise and it's scary, but people are like, yeehaw, society's fallen, let's go kill everything. And in the first days, I really wanted it to be a realistic reaction to, I want to survive. I will do what I have to do to survive, but I may not be comfortable with what I'm doing, but I still want to retain my humanity. I still want to be a person I can live with at the end of the day. I have to find this balance, and I have to mourn. And mourning was a thing that I got criticized for, the fact that my characters in the book mourn. They don't only mourn the loss of their families, their loved ones, and their friends, but of the entire world, an entire way of life. They know the world is over. It will never look the same way it used to be. They will never drive to the grocery store. They will never go to the movies. They will never get on a plane. They will never do all the things that they used to do. The world has ended, and they mourn, and that's very unusual. But it was something that I felt was real based on a lot of my research of adverse situations. So that's why that's there, because I think if you don't have that human component, that part of the human equation, then it's just a story about corpses eating people and people shooting them.
Sorry, we're reflecting on that. it was one of my favorite things about the book was you have these very realistic characters, realistic settings. Your settings, I have to say, school gym. Why have we never seen school gyms before? Even though it made so much sense. The second you put it out there, I was like, oh, of course. That would be like the best place for, you know, hundreds of zombies to be hanging out, because that's where everybody's going to be going in a, you know, national emergency sort of situation.
There are hospitals, which you also have.
Hospitals, right. I loved it. And even the camp, the fact that, you know, Jenny's son is at a campground. It was a very unusual place based on past zombie narratives that most. I mean, obviously, you mentioned it a few times. At least it's not at a mall.
not to say that a mall may not show up in the future.
Right,
but yeah.
Exactly. But
I mean, because malls are used. But.
Right, but it's going to be, you know, just a facet of life as opposed to, you know, the main setting. Was that just inspired by, I mean, I reading a little bit about it, you travel a lot through Texas. Did you just want to show more of the world that they would be living in, or was there something more specific in showing those locations, like the school gym, which is a very kind of haunting image, you know, the destruction of things that seem good, that are good in day-to-day life, and in this world are definitely not good places at all.
Well, I come from an area of Texas originally that was basically, you know, where hurricanes would just come in and just decimate things, you know, where we were used to the concept of shelters. You know, there were shelters that were always set up in school gyms or in churches. Who were the frontline people at all of these trying to deal with all the destruction or trying to rescue people and stuff? Were the police officers, the firemen, the medics? You know, hospitals were the place where everybody goes when they're injured. So, and I also had a friend at that time who was an evacuee from Katrina and lived through some of the worst of it. And I had actually asked her a lot of questions as well. And so I wanted to be realistic about where people would have been located and what would have happened. And one of the things that is dangerous in the first days is the fact that people who escaped the city, who may be infected, are heading out into the rural area, infecting more people. So they're spreading the contagion. And so I try to be realistic with my localities. I try to be realistic with the people in the book, because of my job as a government consultant at the time, I was in rural Texas constantly talking to everyday people, you know, talking to city secretaries, mayors, city council people, sheriffs, deputies, talking with people that were applying for the program that I used to work on, which were just the everyday folk. You know, I saw these people and I thought, you know, I never see you in anything. You're not out there, you know. And I wanted to give their environment and the characters a realistic feel to that. And I'm very glad that came across, because it was something I did think about quite earnestly.
Switching gears real quick. One thing, a really cool point about your book is that your people, the people in your novel, are actually aware of the zombie tropes.
Yeah, that was fun, actually.
Which I have never seen before, and it just didn't make any sense. How do we have all these zombie stories in, like, 2000 whatever, and nobody is, like, ever heard of a zombie? It just seems to me, like, because you watch all these movies, and then people go and hang out with, like, their zombified relatives, and then I'm like, wait. But even if you've never seen a zombie movie, your first instinct when someone's, like, going crazy and eating people is, like, maybe I should just not hang out with him.
Right, exactly. And one of the reasons why I had that actually be in the story is because I thought, even if this is an alternate world from ours, I still think that they would have zombie films or you know, I still think that it would be a part of their culture. And my excuse, you know, somebody got really mad at me about it. And I just said to them, look, you don't think that right now somewhere in this world, there's a scientist not trying to reanimate the dead because they saw it, you know, in George Romero films?
The Russians already did it.
Well, you see, my point's proven. I mean, people are going, I mean, it just seems like, you know, like I pointed out, Star Trek fans growing up to be adults entered into all sorts of different industries and wanted to have what was in the TV show in the 60s. That's why we have iPads and smartphones and computers, because people wanted to create, bring into reality things that they had seen in science fiction. They want those things to be real. So if there's zombies running around eating people, someone out there is going to think this is a great idea if we can control them. So, you know, that's my reasoning for why they know that there's zombies, that somebody out there was probably messing around and made them. I never give a reason for why they're zombies, because I just felt like people in rural Texas in the middle of freaking nowhere, they're never going to know. Nobody would know.
And they kind of don't care. All they care about is living.
Yeah, they just kind of want to live. I mean, it's not like, let's go to the CDC in Atlanta and find out why this is happening. They're more like, let's build another wall. Let's go get supplies. Let's find more guns. I mean, personally, I wouldn't want to go. I mean, I would want to be safe. I think that's my main thing.
And they're just happy that at least one of the rules of zombies works, which is you shoot them in the head and they go down.
Yeah, that's Juan de la Torre. He's like, well, at least that one works. And I like the part where he gets really mad. They're breaking the rules. I mean, he's just like really irate about that. So is Jenny, though. Jenny's really offended by it.
They're supposed to be slow. And
the fact that Jenny is the first one, you know, at least out of Katie and Jenny, I think it goes back to your whole dissociative thing that she has going on. For her, it's really easy to accept that they're just zombies. And who cares beyond that? As long as we know a couple of things. One, bite, probably not a great thing. And two, there's got to be a way to kill them. As long as we know those two things, what more do we care about? And you actually bring that up a couple times with the, you know, when they're watching the news and the CDC is freaking out over it's got to be science, you know, and everybody else is going, yeah, but they're killing everything, so
this is kind of pointless discussion.
Just kind of give it up. Exactly. This really isn't the most fruitful discussion we're having here. So was that more just a breaking the kind of the zombie traditions, or do you think that was more just this is how things would play out if this actually happened?
I think I like breaking tropes. I'm not going to lie. I think one of the biggest tropes that I broke was the female character actually not screaming and yelling and running around. Though I have to give total props to Galen Ross from the original Dawn of the Dead movie when she told George A. Romero, I will not run, I will not scream, and I will not fall down.
Thank you.
And that he and she ended up handling a gun, and she's the one who learned how to fly the helicopter in that film. And that's she's still to this day one of the big my big heroes of film. And I remember being asked in another interview, they said, well, who did you like better, Anna from the remake of Dawn of the Dead or Galen Ross's character of Fran? And I said, I liked Galen Ross's character because if you consider the time period of the 70s and the time period that she was in, how she stood up for herself. So, yes, I like breaking tropes. The first trope I broke right away was the female characters actually not screaming and yelling and running around. They mourn, which is unusual. They know about zombies. They create community instead of breaking down community. They think ahead. They try to anticipate what's going to happen. Things do not go well for them. There's a couple of scenes where they have unexpected events happen and they get really afraid. And I wanted to also, like, the trope that I had some fun breaking was just the whole concept that even though these dead, mindless creatures can't think for themselves, they somehow are smarter than humans at getting to them. So I had fun humans actually anticipating and being smart about the zombies. So that was kind of like, you know, I'm not going to go walking down the street by myself unarmed, you know.
I think
I rambled a bit on that answer, but that's kind of like where I was coming from. I wanted it to be realistic. How would I react? How would my family react? I even asked my nephew, who was 10 years old at the time, what would you do?
And what did you say?
He says, if you get bitten, I'm killing you. I go, thank you.
I think
at least, well, you know, like my children, they're pretty sure that's what you would do in a zombie invasion. My daughter's favorite film when she was about 3 years old was 28 Days Later.
That's probably
a bad move on my part as a parent, but she's a pretty cool kid. So
my brother called me up. Because every time they visit for Christmas or whatever, after Christmas is done, on the 26th is usually zombie-a-thon, and we end up watching all our favorite zombie movies, and the kids are ages 10 to 15 right now, the older kids, and there's a smaller group that's 1 and 5, but, you know, they don't get to see these movies, but the older kids do. And they are bloodthirsty, and they play, you know, all the zombie games that are out there, and my brother called me up about a week after one of their visits. I think it was a spring break. And he calls me and goes, I want you to know, sister, that I know that should the zombies rise, my kids are going to be ruthless. They are going to be fine. I don't have to worry about them. They will survive anything. I'm like,
so true.
Yeah. And he goes, well, how do you know this? He says, well, I asked, you know, Jacqueline, what will you do if daddy gets bitten? Are you going to take care of me? She goes, yeah, I'll shoot you in the head. It's okay.
Brutal honesty I love from children.
Oh. Yeah. The only people who survive are the kids. No. Yes. I mean, no.
Oh, right? So, because they've got practice. I mean, let's just be honest here. They have practice from video games. So.
Okay. So the. I'm sorry. Go
really
ahead.
Quick. Jason Sanford actually, was it Jason Sanford, I think, just had his piece on why you won't survive the zombie apocalypse. Mm-hmm. Am I getting that wrong, Sean? Did you read this?
I think he wrote something about it a couple weeks ago, yeah.
And basically it's because we're all too out of shape to survive the zombie apocalypse.
Well, because they don't really get tired. They just run and run and run and run.
And most of us are just
a little
not
pudgy around the midsection.
Section. Well, it depends if they're running or walking, though, too.
Right. If you have slow zombies.
I'm with Max Brooks and Jonathan Mayberry about the Zompocalypse. I do believe that that humanity would survive the Zompocalypse. The numbers vary, like the estimates of how many people would actually survive. I think it was like 3 billion was the idea. No, was it 3 billion? But, I mean, but there's like numbers that change, like from the millions to, you know, the low billions or whatever. Right. But they believe that Jonathan Mayberry and I were actually discussing this at Horror Realm last year. And I said, I'm an optimist. I do believe we would overcome. I do believe we would win because they would eventually decay. They would eventually break down. The importance right. of the zombie would be to replicate itself before it would be destroyed. And in my book, the zombies, if they know you're on the other side of a metal door, they're going to beat themselves against that metal door. They're going to break their teeth. They're going to, you know, claw their fingers down to nubs. They're going to break their arms trying to get through a fence. They might even rip their head off trying to go past a clothesline, you know, because they don't feel pain. And that would be our advantage because they would eventually destroy themselves. But yes, I do believe that, you know, in the beginning, people being, you know, not fit or not being properly armed or prepared or just having disbelief that it was happening would be the reason why the zombies would rise extremely quickly outside of Texas.
Makes sense.
Screw you, rest of the world.
We're fine.
Well, just real quick, the last zombie-related question because we're running out of time. So every time we have somebody who writing something zombie-related comes on the show, we ask this question because we're curious basically the answer. Basically, you know, why is it that we're so terrified of zombies? What is it to you that just makes us afraid? Why zombie? Why are we fixated on zombies as scary things?
Well, I think humanity's always been a little bit afraid of death. We have, you know, extreme death rituals that we undergo to put the dead in the ground. And for a long time, that had to do with the fact that we didn't want them coming back up. I mean, we have a lot of mythology about the corpses coming back to life. Even before Romero created the modern day zombie, which he called ghouls originally, I mean, there was a lot of mythology about the dead. I think death was the great unknown and a frightening thing to us. I think it still is. We do everything in our power to try to avoid death, even though we will all die one day. Well, I've got plans, but you know. But zombies also kind of go even deeper because we live in a time of uncertainty. You know, the housing collapse, the economy being what it is. You know, just there's so much that's going on that it's kind of a relief to be afraid of something that probably will never happen. And zombies are that thing. You know, it's fun to plan about it. It's fun to talk about it. You know, because it's not gonna happen. I mean, what's more likely to happen is that you will have a natural disaster occur or you'll lose a job. So zombies are a way to be afraid, but to be safe. And I think the other reason why we're afraid of zombies is because zombies could end up being our own family members and our friends. and they would be coming for us and we would be alone. And I think that's a very terrifying thing, to lose your support system and your community, and to be alone is a very, very frightening thing. So I think it really kind of taps into a lot of different areas of our psyche. Of course, there are the people who would love the zompocalypse to happen because they hate society and they hate their neighbors and they would have a lot of fun shooting them. So, you know, I'm of the mindset of, do I think it's going to happen? No, but I would never count it out because science is sometimes a very scary thing.
It could. I mean, you could. It wouldn't happen in the supernatural sense, perhaps, but certainly an infection of some kind. I mean, they already did. Didn't the CDC or somebody did a study where they thought that a mutated rabies virus mixed with the bubonic or something, or the Ebola or something, could possibly produce a zombie-like infection?
A rage virus, like from 28 days and 28 weeks later, would be more likely than actually reanimated dead. And I think a virus like that is a terrifying idea for a lot of people. That's a little bit more realistic to me, and that would be the kind of quote-unquote zombie that I would think would be more likely than the shambling undead. Of course, I could just be saying that because I live near three different cemeteries, but, you know.
Yeah, I actually specifically chose my house based on the proximity away from cemeteries. It's the first thing I look at in houses. I know that's weird, but always have.
My house actually is backed up to a cemetery. I'm always like, well, when it happens, we'll know ahead of everybody else.
We'll be the first to go.
Well, I don't know.
Or not.
I've got my shotgun.
Yeah.
You know. My husband's like, I'm like, if this apocalypse happens, honey, what do? He goes, we grab the pets. Yep. We grab the pets, grab the guns, go out the front door. I'm like, all right, we're good.
Cool.
Yeah,
so, quiet, Jen. You're interrupting me.
Sorry.
So what can we expect from you in the future?
Well, I do have other books out. The First Days is the book I have out from tour, but I do have a book called The Living Dead Boy and the Zombie Hunters, which was written for my nieces and nephews because they're bloodthirsty, and it's about a young boy and his friends facing the zompocalypse. And it's been optioned for film, and things are actually really going well in that department. So maybe it'll reach the big screen. And again, it's The Living Dead Boy and the Zombie Hunters. And I've written two vampire novels. One of them's in modern day Texas. It's called Pretty When She Dies. And that one I self-published, and it's pretty popular. It has a pretty rabid following, and it has zombies, necromancers, and vampires. And then I wrote another vampire tale, which is more like the old Hammer films, the old Bela Lugosi film. Takes place in Europe during the Regency era, 1820. It's called The Tale of the Vampire Bride, and the sequel is about to come out. It's called The Vengeance of the Vampire Bride. And I'm just, you know, constantly writing. I just put out, it's called As the World Dies, Untold Tales. It's three different stories. One's a novella and two are short stories. You find out in this book what happens to Katie's wife, Lydia, on that first day. You also get to meet two other characters who are going to be in Fighting to Survive, which is a sequel to The First Days. So you get like a little introduction to their backstory before you actually get to see them in the second book. And I put that out for the fans because it was stories that I had written a while back, and they wanted a little bit more. So I put that out for them. So, fantastic. And that's called As the World Dies, Untold Tales. So, and I'm about to start writing a futuristic zombie novel, so which I wasn't planning on writing, but you know, the idea came to me. I was like, oh, I'm gonna go with this. It's kind of fun. I've got a lot of ideas for a lot of different kinds of books. I'm very prolific. I don't lack for ideas, which is kind of bad. So, but but if anybody who wants to know what's going on with me can check RhiannonFrater.com or AsTheWorldDies.com, and I have a blog called RhiannonFrater.blogspot.com. So, and I'm on Facebook. People can find me. And I do try to keep the fans up to date on everything that's going on. Everything that I've written so far has been optioned for film or TV. So I try to keep them kind of going with what's going on in that department, what I'm writing, what's coming out next, my appearances and stuff like that. So
great.
Fantastic. We'll make sure there's links to all of that in the show notes.
Okay.
And we'll demand that people buy everything.
Well, the thing is I love my fans. I love hearing from them. And I you know, I'm successful because of them. They have been the wind literally beneath my wings. They've been the ones that have pushed me to this point in my life, and I'm very, very grateful. So I do try to keep those lines of connection open with them and keep them informed.
Excellent.
Awesome. Thank you, Rhiannon.
No problem. Yeah. Thank you. This is fun.
It is fun. It's awesome. It's great. Cool. So we got to close out the show. So if anybody wants to send us messages, which you really shouldn't, you should send them all to her, unless you want to say hate mail, and then we can send it anonymously on. But that would be really mean because you're really nice, so we won't do that. But in the event that you want to send us hate mail about us, that which also is fun, you can do that in three ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
A very short hate tweet.
Yes, twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
You can leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.wordpress.com.
Or you can go on our Google Plus and do it that way.
Yes, Shawnee Jen.
Which is fun. So thank you so much for being on the show.
No problem.
It was really fun, and we'll have you on again for sure.
Yes.
Cool.
You'll be back. We're not done with you. We're like zombies. We always come back.
Oh, I got to lock and load.
Yes, indeed. She at least has guns, so she can get rid of us. The rest of them aren't so lucky.
Cool. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. We will see you all on the flip side.
Bye.
Bye.
Caution. You have entered the Podstruction Zone. Please secure all podcatchers. Caution.
How's it coming, guys?
This won't go any faster if you keep interrupting.
Got it. Here's some steampunk, diesel punk, gothic punk.
Goth punk?
Gothic. Trust me on this.
Hey, you're the one who invited him to the show, Sean. I've got epic fantasy, sword and sorcery, and all the news on ebooks.
That's it. Check it out. Clock punk. Ooh, shiny.
I have space opera, time travel, Stargate, and...
Sean, is that He-Man?
Shut up. Boys, I think we did it.
A superior podcast.
Publishing, writing, genre, best-selling authors, and the hot new writers of today.
Editors and agents, contests? Did we leave anything out?
AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com.
Subscribe today to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature since 2006.
Sean?
It's just so beautiful.
Podstruction complete. Enjoy.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.